I'm Jen White. Ruth Bader Ginsburg dedicated her career to the fight for gender equality even before her time on the Supreme Court. Early in her career, she challenged laws that discriminated on the basis of sex. As a Supreme Court justice, she wrote the opinion striking down the men-only admissions policy of the Virginia Military Academy, and her dissent in a case involving pay discrimination in the workplace led to the enactment of the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. But wage discrimination is deeply rooted in our employment system, and the COVID-19 pandemic has only highlighted just how much work we still need to do. With me now to talk more about how the coronavirus is affecting women is Nicole Mason. She's the president and CEO of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Nicole, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thank you for having me. Really, I really love the introduction, so all good.
Thanks.
All good, timely topics.
Also with us is Dr. Callie Cyrus. She's a practicing community psychiatrist and assistant professor at Johns Hopkins Medicine. Dr. Cyrus, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Really glad to join.
So, Nicole, first, where does the country currently stand in terms of total job loss as a result of the pandemic?
So over the last few months, we've lost about 13 million jobs, and we have only regained about 2 million of those jobs, but more important is that there have been about 60 million jobless claims across the country.
Now, in an op-ed you penned for USA Today, you said at the beginning of the year, we were celebrating the fact that women made up a little more than 50% of the workforce for the first time in over a decade. But women workers have been hit particularly hard by the pandemic. What does that employment number look like now?
So at the start of the pandemic, or in March, the unemployment rate for women was about 4%. And now it's hovering around 14%. And last month, it was around 16%. And for women of color, Black and Latino women, the numbers are steady and a bit starker because of their overrepresentation in the service sector.
And what does that number look like right now?
For Black women, it's about 15%. And for Latino women, it's around the same. But again, last month, it was a bit higher. It was about 18% for Black women and 19% for Latino women.
Now, at the start of the economic shutdown, women were losing their jobs at a faster rate, even in male-dominated industries. Why were we losing jobs at such a disproportionate rate?
The sectors hardest hit as a result of COVID have been the service sector or service sector jobs. So those are, you know, restaurants, leisure and hospitality, education, healthcare, and all those sectors are overrepresented. But, you know, there's a disproportionate number of women in those jobs. And so when the stay-at-home orders came into effect and restaurants closed, those jobs were lost.
Well, as Sasha Ann Simons talked about in her reporting, many women who aren't working right now didn't necessarily lose their jobs, but the lack of childcare has forced them to stay at home. And we heard from two of our listeners who had to stop working because they can't find childcare.
This is Natalie calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I am a middle school ESL teacher. Under normal circumstances, my mother-in-law watches my one-year-old daughter, but unfortunately this year, she understandably was not comfortable watching my daughter if I was in person with kids, which my district is. She told me one day too late for me to get into the online program. So I've had to go on leave for the year and make other plans. Fortunately, I have tenure, so my spot is going to be held for me.
My name's Terry. I'm in Florida. I watched my best friend quit her job when she had twins. And about the time she was getting ready to go back to work, she had another one and then another one. And childcare costs don't make it an option for her to go back to work. This has actually created a huge financial strain on her family. Having childcare options that were safe and affordable would make a huge difference on her life.
So, Dr. Cyrus, what types of resources or legislation would you like to see to help parents with childcare?
Well, I think that it's time for I'm going to say states to actually step up to the plate and provide some of this funding. I think that we given the sort of standoff that we see happening federally, I think we're really looking for agencies to be able to buffer some of what's happening. And that's not been the case. There's actually, we know a lot of social services have actually been cut out. So when you have a system like the educational system that's already underfunded and has under resources, we really need states to actually be able to not cut those right now. I know that we're in a pandemic and money is hard for folks to be funding, given everything that's going on. But I think that it's time to actually start helping some of these people that were already behind when the pandemic first started. I think that's something that, you know, we're talking about this as if people with childcare, mothers with childcare, didn't have these problems before, but there were already women and families that had childcare difficulties before the pandemic started that are hit even harder. So first, by starting with the funding for programs that were already underfunded, and then some emergency funding for folks to be able to actually afford to take care of their kids because they don't have the grandparents anymore or other resources that they were able to rely on.
Well, we got this message from Donna on Facebook. She says, the way our systems are set up do not support women leading a family. It is systemic suppression disguised as freedom, just like systemic racism. You know, Nicole, much of this conversation is focused around childcare, but help us understand why childcare is so inaccessible.
So so the person on Facebook is right. The system is broken and it has been for some time, and it hasn't been working for women and families. And for many women, we've just worked to figure it out. But I think the pandemic has laid bare that many of our systems, health, the economy, and the childcare infrastructure wasn't working for families. So many women internalized it and believed it was their problem to solve. And now we're seeing that it is a systemic issue and one that needs addressing both at the federal level and state levels through policy, but also improving employer practices.
Dr. Cyrus, we're talking about this in terms of childcare, but we also know women are more likely to be the caregiver, not only for a child, but for an aging parent or a sick relative. What toll does that take on working women?
Oh, it's an incredible toll. I mean, I think women are already used to sort of being the central person in their families, having to take care and balance all of these multiple sort of conflicting tasks. And I think even more than now, they're having to do all this plus the stress of the pandemic. And so imagine all of the women who are, again, overburdened already, who are now having to deal with this in a situation like this. And we know that women, just gender norms are incredibly set, right? They're very static. They're not things that change very easily. So even if you have husbands or other people in the family who are taking up some of the burden, it's not going to be to an extent that's going to be durable, you know, lasts a long time. Because when people are stressed, they revert back to their prior habits. And so women are continually just having to sort of, you know, stay up to this challenge. And then if you think about women of color, especially, you know, you have stereotypes like strong Black women, but you have women who are used to operating like this under pressure. And that amount of stress, actually, I see amounts to akin to like a traumatic sort of response. There's an ongoing trauma of having to keep doing this. Studies have been showing that women are even more overburdened than they were before the crisis and already feel like that they can't keep up with all of their multiple tasks. So I worry about the mental health impact.
I want to read this comment to you. It came from Jen Ann on Facebook. She says, I'm self-employed and stopped working to take care of my kids. I'm immunocompromised, so daycare isn't an option. Plus, my husband's work provides health care. Mine didn't. I miss the sense of accomplishment and autonomy that my work gave me, but I love that I get to be fully present for these precious early years. Women can have it all, just not at the same time. It is unfair. And what really stood out for me there, Nicole, was this issue of health care, that she didn't have health care through her job, but her husband did. How much does that play into this conversation?
So the women who have been most impacted and have lost jobs are women who tend to be in lower wage jobs, jobs with less job security benefits, including health care, and few economic savings to ride out an economic downturn. So what that means is that women are having to make these really tough choices. And just by the way, when there's a choice in a family about who needs to off-ramp or, you know, stop working in order to meet the caretaking responsibilities of this moment, it's usually women. And so the story that you just shared with us, or the comment, is it's not unusual. And And what, again, it's a perfect storm because we haven't addressed issues around job quality or the lack of health insurance for lower-income families or families who are working in the service sector. And these stories are reflective of that.
I also want to read this message from Timothy, who writes on Facebook, I would kill to spend just 1 week at home with my children, but my job won't allow it. I envy moms who get to stay home all week with their children and watch them grow. Dr. Cyrus, your response?
I think that is, it's a sweet response, right? To be able to want to spend that time with your kids. And we think everyone during the pandemic right now has that option to be spending more time with their kids, but, and not to forget about men and also what they might be going to having to support women or whoever is taking care of their families. But I think the point that this brings up is that everyone is under stress. While this segment is focused on women, I think we also think about women and their families and also women of intersectional identities and how everybody and the family structure is being impacted by this. And so there, you have to, if we're commenting on the responsibility to others in the family, imagine those who have to go to work, who have to come back home despite being exposed to potentially COVID-19, but also know that they might have to stay in a dead-end job, that's their main sort of responsibility. And what that does to your identity, sort of feeling diminished and not being able to be a father, a son, but having to be the breadwinner, the person who has to go to work because your family is dependent on you. And these are some of the reasons why we're seeing, rates of depression have gone up compared to last year. I think for nearly 45% of at least studies are showing that folks are more depressed than they were last year. So this is definitely being reflected in the research, and it's not just women, it's everybody.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. We're discussing the impact of the coronavirus on women in the workforce. My guests are Nicole Mason, President and CEO of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, and Callie Cyrus of Johns Hopkins Medicine. You know, Nicole, I wonder if this could potentially open up a new conversation about parental leave and what it means to create a system where parents, full stop, are able to better support their families.
So I also want to mention the comment from the guy who said he wished he could stay home. I think there's an assumption about what's happening when women are at home. And so as a mom myself, I have 10-year-old twins, but I'm also working remotely. So I'm working 40 hours a week and also trying to homeschool. So it's not so much that I'm sitting in playtime and playgroups with my children. It's an unfair, impossible burden that women who are usually the primary caretakers in their families have also had to shoulder in this moment. So I just wanted to say that because that's what complicates this discussion a bit more because women already spent a disproportionate amount of time on caretaking responsibilities, and now they have a double burden, especially women of color who are more likely to be the primary wage earners in their family. So I just wanted to say that. And then when we think about, I am really hopeful that this pandemic provides us an opportunity to think about an economy that works for working women and their families, including male partners. We don't have a great paid leave structure or family medical leave in most states and for most workers. And so I'm hoping that some of the things that we have done during this moment, during the pandemic, we're able to institutionalize at both the federal and state levels.
Well, in many families where both parents work, women are still perceived as the caregivers and more of the household and family tasks fall on them. And we heard from one of our listeners who's going through this right now.
Hi, my name's Haley. I am from Ransomville, New York. I am one of those women who has been fortunate enough to keep her job, but I am also a new mom. I'm a full-time student and a full-time worker, and the full-time responsibility of taking care of my infant is still on me, despite having a husband at home who is also full-time employed, remote work from home. So keep in mind that there's still ladies out there that are bearing the burden, even though they are in an equal situation with their male partners because of ingrained stereotypes.
Well, Anne also tweets, I would like to know why moms feel more responsibility to make it work-family balance, than dads do. I mean, Dr. Cyrus, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this, again, goes back to just thinking about the norms and the stereotypes stereotypes that characterize how we think of American culture. And the working mother or the mother at home taking care of the child is something that is just so ingrained in mainstream culture and in our society. And so these norms don't change overnight. And that means that the man is usually the one that we see who's not doing any of the housework or who's doing less of the child care. And that's, again, the same as what's happening during this pandemic. Even again, if folks are trying to split out some of the responsibilities, when you are pushed to the max, which people are, right? There was a recent survey that was showing that 31% of women with full-time jobs and families say they have more to do than they can possibly handle, but only 13% of working men with families said the same. So even if I think what men are trying to help out or trying to shoulder some of that burden, you're going to fall back into the norms that are the way that our society is sort of ingrained, our work structure, our family structure.
Why are those norms so hard to shake? Why are they so hard to shake?
It's still hard to shape. Can you undo, you know, hundreds of years of, you know, think about all the history that we learn from in so many contexts, right? It's always the male presidents, the male doctors. It's subliminal. It's explicit, you know, implicit as well. It's everywhere. So you have to intentionally pay attention to when you see your mind sort of validating some of these stereotypes to actually not sort of see it in that way. And when you have so many things to do, are you so vigilant that you can try to adjust and do this sort of self-learning on your own? We all reinforce it, even when we don't mean to. I mean, I think this conversation is focused on women and caregiving when, you know, women are having full-time jobs. It just took a few comments before we actually commented on the women who are working full-time jobs. It's just a way that...
I think Dr. Cyrus's line dropped. We'll try to get her back in a moment. In the meantime, Nicole, we got this message from Paul who says, with online schooling being such a nightmare and requiring more attention from parents, I think we'll see more promotion bias in favor of employees who don't have children. More than ever before, this might have some justification. Your thoughts?
So I think he is right. And I think the pandemic will have long-term effects on women's career mobility, promotion, ability to re-enter the workforce. It's really devastating. And like at the beginning of the year, we were celebrating 50% of the workforce. And now it's just regressed and we've lost so many jobs. And so it's really, unless we are able to deal with this childcare crisis head on, it will take us longer to recover.
I'm Jen White. We're discussing how the pandemic has affected working women. My guests are Nicole Mason, president and CEO of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, and Callie Cyrus of Johns Hopkins Medicine. We want to hear from you. What have you experienced during the pandemic as a working mother? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or drop us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Jen White. We're taking a look at why women are often the ones who are forced to choose between work and family, especially during the pandemic. My guests are Callie Cyrus of Johns Hopkins Medicine and Nicole Mason of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. And I want to pick up the conversation with a piece you wrote for the Lily, Nicole, called "The System Was Never Designed for Working Moms." And in it, you write, quote, "This epiphany has led many, including myself, to rethink the burdens and high expectations placed on women with caretaking responsibilities in the workforce and in society. Why am I apologizing for having to leave work to take care of a sick family member? Why am I working through the night? Why did I work up until my baby was practically crowning and throughout my maternity leave?" Now, Dr. Cyrus, we were talking about the expectations of women and how difficult it is to, I guess, deprogram ourselves, but how are you helping people answer those questions for themselves?
So I'm helping people based on who they are when they come to me, which is why this is such a complex issue. You know, I like to stress that when we're talking about women of all intersectional identities. So women who are childless, women with children, gay and lesbian women, trans women. So you have to look at who's coming before you. And I think it varies based on that. So if I'm looking at a woman who happens to be in my age group, who's a millennial woman, I'm already thinking about what this woman has had to deal with over their life course. And so we know there's a lot of research now being done about millennial women who are typically between the ages of 20 and 39, right now who are having to now go through this phase of starting their family, wanting to solidify their identity as a worker, but having to take care of these young kids in the middle of a pandemic, also having to go through the recession in 2008. And so imagine the amount of trauma that builds up from, you know, trying to determine who you are and figure this all out. And then you're in the middle of ongoing trauma. If I'm looking at a woman who might be a single mother or who might also be a queer woman who is a single mother and who's working alone, imagine what they have to bear. They don't have the support of their family who may be living next door, who would typically be watching their children. So I really take the patient who's coming in front of me and help them do some, one, just some supportive sort of ego building. Like, you can get through this. You've gotten through this before. But also to recognize when you're having a hard time going through it, which is something that I would say is a bit of a silver lining right now, is that we're seeing a lot more people who are interested in seeking mental health treatment, which is a sign that we're recognizing that we can't do everything. This is really pushing people to their breaking points.
Well, we got this tweet from Rick who says, just listening to this conversation has me reflecting about how I unconsciously just expect my wife to look after the kids. It has me thinking, what kind of stress is she under that she's not showing? I needed this. Happy to be here for you, Rick, and for your wife. You know, as we're learning more about the lasting physical effects of the coronavirus, we're also learning more about the mental toll it's taking, as you're saying, Dr. Cyrus. And it seems stress from the pandemic is having a greater impact on women than on men. A recent Kaiser poll showed that 53% of women who responded reported a significant negative impact on their mental health, compared to only 37% of men. Dr. Cyrus, do we know what that is, why that is? Are women, is this part of women maybe being more open than men about discussing mental health?
I think in general, that's typically the case, is that women tend to be a bit more emotive. And so perhaps that's why they are expressing these emotions much more than men. I think also, just to sort of be intuitive about it, is that a lot of the men are at work focused on work tasks, while women are at home confronted with the childcare, with the care of the home itself, not having their husband around. So there's a lot more time for these things to be on your mind. So I could imagine that it's more present and a bit more of a force that results in these numbers. Women also tend to have higher rates of depression in general. So again, we're thinking about pre-pandemic and some of the vulnerabilities that women are coming to the table with, and how something like a pandemic just exposes those vulnerabilities, which is why we're probably seeing the numbers at those rates.
I mean, and when we think about this, the mental health aspect of this, do we know how job loss, specifically during the pandemic, is affecting mental health more severely?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. I think that it differs in how we discuss this. So we're seeing a lot of research that is citing things like anxiety or rates of depression, which are really easy to capture. But I think the way that I've been thinking about it is from a trauma perspective. So when we think about trauma, we usually think about some sort of inciting event that's either physically, emotionally, or socially traumatic. But then there's also this concept of complex trauma, which is more over time, interpersonal exposure, a wider range, multiple events, kind of like a little T trauma. And what I've found is that the pandemic itself is a traumatic event that is ongoing, right? And so if you already had a history of complex trauma, if you're in a domestic abuse, or you are a Black woman who's in a work environment that's wrought with microaggressions, you're already predisposed to this complex trauma. That's what your day-to-day is. And then you have the acute stressor of the pandemic. And then every day you have triggers, right? You turn on a radio, we're talking about it now. That's a trigger that makes you just consider all of the stress that you're under. And with that comes the physiological, the body response of trouble breathing, heart racing, hands shaking, the world is coming to a doom. And this is these actually fit the diagnosis of PTSD when it's longer than a month, which it happens to be that this is an ongoing pandemic. So I think that, you know, we're past talking about it in terms of anxiety or depression. I think that we're really gearing up for a pandemic of trauma.
Well, and Nicole, we know that access to mental health support can be challenging, especially when we look at the ways in which our healthcare is tied to employment. How does that fit into this conversation?
So when we think about women getting back to work, at least some of the women that I've spoken to, long stretches of being out of the workforce is definitely emotionally trying, but also psychologically trying because a lot of women blame themselves for not being able to get back into the workforce or because of job loss. And then to burden or to add the burden of not being able to homeschool or having difficulties with the other with other caretaking responsibilities, it does have a, again, emotional, psychological impact on working mothers. And just going back to the piece about the system, whether it's not being set up for working mothers. So if the system was already not working for mothers before the pandemic, it has only worsened since the start of it. And so women have an additional burden of how to figure out how to do it all, you know, during the pandemic. And for those who have lost their jobs or exited the workforce, how they might be able to re-enter and for some women, their earnings will be cut or they won't, you know, have enough to be able to make ends meet. So that is also, you know, pretty stressful.
And what kind of barriers to care exist, Dr. Cyrus?
Oh, so many barriers to care exist. So we're talking about a mental health system that was already under-resourced. You know, I think there are some numbers that were saying that, well, one, there's a shortage of psychiatrists that we're expecting by 2025, if we're just talking about me and sort of my role. But we also don't generally have access to therapists. There are some counties, I think I was reading, that maybe one in three counties actually has a licensed clinical psychologist. There's not enough of the supply. I think that's the start. And then two, you've had a shifting in finances from inpatient hospitals to the community, but that money hasn't actually made it down to providers. And so if you think of this in a stepwise fashion, you have a psychiatric emergency or you actually need to get care right away, the place that you would go isn't necessarily set up to take care of you because of decreased funding. And so then you try to go an outpatient provider and get connected to a therapist or a psychiatrist in the community, and they're more than likely not taking insurance. How do you afford them? So does your insurance carry these therapists and this mental health access? And typically they don't. Most mental health providers are out of pocket. You know, for a 45-minute new evaluation for someone who's really psychotic, who has schizophrenia, I might get reimbursed $147. For someone who does a 20-minute cataract surgery, a surgeon, he's going to get $765. So you can imagine that the incentive for therapists and psychiatrists of color and women, right, who make up most of the health, a lot of the healthcare force at this point, especially with doctors, how are we going to participate in this system? And so I think that we're going to have to see a shift in where we are putting our money in the mental health system, which means we're going to need parity. I think right now we're in a really interesting transition point with that. Telepsych has been expanded. So the federal government has allowed reimbursement to occur through Medicare in wider circumstances. So more insurance companies are allowing folks to be able to get telepsych care and get reimbursed for it. But what's going to happen after the pandemic? And then also don't forget about the 21 million who don't have internet and how they're getting access to internet as well. So I think that I'd really like to see telepsych be expanded after the pandemic. And I'd like to see equal reimbursement and I'd like to see parity so that people are reimbursed for the care that they provide. And let's value mental health as it should be valued.
You know, Nicole, there's a very specific subset of women workers I want to touch on more, and that's the female essential worker.
My name is Lauren Murtis, and I'm from Fargo, North Dakota. I am a nurse at the Fargo VA. I have three young children. We have had a really hard time with the pandemic. My husband got laid off of his job for about 3 months, and I am a nurse, and so I was essential, and I had to be at the hospital. I work overnight shifts, and so I have found myself needing to go home, sleep while my kids are working on school, get up, try to correct their school, and then go to work overnight, and then in the morning take them to class if they're doing their hybrid day or their in-person day or needing to get the baby to daycare. It's just been a very, very stressful time.
Nicole, what specific choices have female essential workers had to face?
Well, for some female essential workers, because I just want to say that the definition of essential workers has expanded during the pandemic. So grocery store clerks are workers are essential workers, and many of those are women. For some of these women, you know, it's a hard choice between taking care of their families and going to work. And for some women, it's just not a choice. They have to go to work, like the caller we just had, because if they don't go to work, they don't get paid. They have to physically be there. And so, you know, women are really having tough choices to make and making it work when it just is impossible. So, like she said, sleeping overnight, waking up, checking homework, starting it all over again. And so what this story, these stories that we've heard, you know, in the show raises for me is that there seems to be a real disconnect between what's happening in the lives of women and families and what's the federal and state level response to these families. You know, we still haven't reached a deal for, you know, the CARES Act or some of the other policies that would help ease the burden for families and women. And it doesn't seem like, it seems like there's a disconnect between, you know, what's happening on the ground for women and families and our strategies and solutions to support them.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. We're discussing the impact of the coronavirus on women in the workforce. My guests are Nicole Mason, President and CEO of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, and Callie Cyrus of Johns Hopkins Medicine. I want to turn to this message from Monty on Facebook, who says, it's quickly becoming extremely glaring how stagnant wages since the 1980s means it's even harder to have a one-income household. Nicole, your thoughts?
Yeah, so let's just be honest. The one-income household hasn't been our reality for at least two or three decades. Most households are two income families. In some instances, women are the primary breadwinner in their families. So the idea that there's a male breadwinner and there's a woman who stays home and they're able to make ends meet, it's just not our, hasn't been our economic reality. And so, but what has been our reality is that even though more women work outside of the home, they're still saddled with caretaking responsibilities. Women perform or are responsible for 30% more caretaking responsibilities than their male counterparts. For Black and Latino women, that's even higher. So not only are women working more, but they're, you know, nothing has changed about their caretaking responsibilities. And again, it's been exacerbated as a result of the pandemic. So, this is not 1950s, the 1950s where, you know, one income because of the stagnation of wages and let us not forget the pay gap for women. So even though we're working 40 hours a week, 50 for some women, we're still not making as much as our male counterparts.
We've only got a couple of minutes left here, but Dr. Cyrus, I want to make sure we acknowledge the fact that there's a group of working women who are members of the LGBTQ community, and most of the conversations we have about working parents presume heterosexual relationships. What do we know about how same-sex couples are dealing with these challenges?
So one, there's not as much research as there should be. Most of the research right now on LGBT couples has to do with actually youth and the safety of their households. And so if we extrapolate that, we can only think, as research generally shows, that so many LGBTQ women are exposed to sexual violence in some sort of way. And imagine what that is like in the household right now, not having a way to escape and being sort of stuck at home if we're thinking about women in that sort of respect. I think the other thing to reflect on is how we think about gender norms. Again, they're pretty static and pretty explainable. We can identify them between men and women. But with LGBTQI couples, those gender roles are a bit more fluid and more flexible. And so you can imagine there might be even more confusion about whose responsibility is to do what. So we may have the responsibilities doled out by who goes to work and who stays at home. But in general, LGBTQI populations have higher rates of smoking. They have higher rates of many chronic illnesses. And so you can imagine if we consider this framework again of how you come to the table before the pandemic and what your predisposition is that they're going to fare much worse, much like women of color, low-income women, non-citizen women, so women with these minority intersectional identities.
Nicole, briefly, for women who have paused their careers during the pandemic to, you know, caretake, what's the expectation that their jobs will still be there when they're ready to go back?
There is no expectation. And for many of the jobs that we lost, some of those are not coming back. So, there will not be a one-for-one replacement. So what this means for some women is that they're going to have to enter new professions altogether, reskilling, additional education, and the professions that they may enter may be lower paying. They have to start at an entry-level position. So we have lost tremendous progress in terms of women in the workforce as a result of the pandemic. And a full recovery will take some time for, you know, for many of the reasons we've mentioned here.
That's Nicole Mason, president and CEO of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, and Callie Cyrus, a community psychiatrist and assistant professor at Johns Hopkins Medicine. Thanks to you both for your time and expertise. We'll wrap on this tweet from Kat, who says, "It sums up the situation for me that I was streaming your show while doing work for a freelance client, and I had to pause listening and working six times in 30 minutes to help my three kids with school questions." Today's producer was Sharla Freeland. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.